I'm John McKay, sitting in today for Chris Boyd. Up next on Think, the little that most of us learned in school about black participation in the American Revolution is usually limited to Crispus Attucks, killed during the Boston Massacre. Less known, four times as many black Americans served as loyalists to the crown than as American patriots. Their motivation? Emancipation from slavery. Scholars argue it has led to a disquieting fiction that enslaved blacks during the era chose not to be free. Professor Farah Peterson of the University of Chicago Law School writes about the Patriot Slave in the American Scholar magazine. She joins us to provide a better understanding of the American founding. Our conversation starts after a short break. Voices missing from the story of the American founding, in particular, the voices and actions of blacks, both free and enslaved, during the period. We know 5,000 fought in the Patriot Army during the war. What's lesser known is 20,000 went to the British side, hoping to secure their freedom. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm John McKay, in today for Chris Boyd. The activities of those missing voices are now coming to light thanks to research by many. Among them, Farah Peterson at the University of Chicago Law School, where she is a professor and legal historian. Her essay for the American Scholar magazine is The Patriot Slave. She joins us now. Farah, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me.
You know, this idea of the loyal, happy slave who's content to live as someone else's property, even to die for them, that's been with us since even before the American Revolution, right?
Oh, absolutely. There's long been an emotional reaction to the problem of slavery. And that emotional reaction changed over the course of the 18th and 19th centuries. But part of it was a persistent fantasy that slaves were happy to be enslaved, that they wouldn't be free if they could. That there was a loyalty that went both ways between the enslaved and their masters.
Now, you've argued that American history, as it's been taught and as we've interpreted it through just about every era, really relegates black Americans to a place as minor characters in the story of white America.
Oh, sure. And you can see this in our textbooks and in the way that we teach our elementary school students about the history of the revolution. Just in February, before everything changed, I went to my public library to try to find a book about the Revolutionary War to share with my six-year-old, because I thought, well, he's not getting history right now in school, but I can start teaching him history. That is, after all, what I do. And I took out every book on the shelf of the children's section about the Revolutionary War, and I paged through them. And some of them were very good, but it was very difficult to find a single one with pictures of African-American soldiers. It made me angry, knowing that a quarter of the Patriot forces at Yorktown, the decisive battle of the war, were black. That the majority of the dead on the battlefield after that battle we're black, and yet we teach a history course to our students that is free of black and other minority faces.
Essentially, what you've been saying, and what you say I got from the essay is that really the way we interpret history is it denies the personhood of black folk during the period.
Oh, absolutely, and it's a it's a problem of what story are we telling ourselves about who we are as a people? Who matters? Who are the protagonists and the epic of America? When we tell a story that has only white characters in it, not only does it erase the full character of those white historical figures, it also demeans and diminishes the real contributions and the real struggle of everyone else who was striving, living, dying in the American Republic for the entire history of its life.
You know, we focus on the British North Americans, but there were also there were Germans here at the time, the French, others among the colonists. So this myth of a docile, happy slave that's part of a, is it part of an effort to create some new concept during the founding? The idea of even though there are people from different countries, they are a white people. Does that make?
Oh yes, it does make sense. And in some of my other research, I've talked about how Americans during the Revolutionary War compared themselves, the white Americans compared themselves to two other groups that they caricatured at the time, the Native American, that white Americans actually donned Indian costume, not just in the famous events of the Boston Tea Party when they dumped tea in the Boston Harbor dressed as Native Americans, but also marching to war. Militias would don this Indian dress and think of themselves as the sort of natural inheritors of this American soil. Were they pretending to be real Native peoples? No, in fact, many of them had fought devastating wars against real Native tribes and nations on the frontier. By donning that costume, they were comparing themselves to a caricature of a Native person. And similarly, on the other side, there was a caricature of the slave, a caricature of a docile and unworthy person. And if you read the pamphlet literature of the American Revolution, you see them talking about slaves everywhere. It was one of the most common words they used, paired with the word tyranny. Americans continued to talk about how they risked making themselves slaves if they did not resist. And it wasn't an abstract concept. George Washington would say, if we permit this kind of behavior from the British, then we will become just like the sooty Africans over whom we hold such an arbitrary sway. And it was between these two poles, imagined caricatures of monolithic racial groups, that Americans created a new group, the white people, that they moved forward with and started to define as the core of a new national identity.
Well, you've hit right on what was my next question, which was this concept of white people. That was something new that was created in this country?
Well, ideas of racial hierarchies were not new. There were all kinds of ideas about the operation of climates and regions on the development of different species of men and their hierarchies. What was sort of unique about the American moment, this Enlightenment moment, was that suddenly, instead of, we were emerging from a world that had been defined by hierarchy as its basis. Kings, aristocracy, merchants, peasants, this is how the world had worked from time immemorial. And coming into a new Enlightenment world, where one of the most dramatic, one of the most radical ideas afoot was this idea of government by consent of the governed. If you have a government by consent, then at least ideally, everyone is equal. Those two ideas are in fact paired. In Thomas Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, he not only says that all men were created equal, but then he goes on to say that governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Well, now that you have a government based on consent and everyone is supposedly equal, how do you justify treating slaves differently? Suddenly, ideas about race became a lot more salient. Ideas that seem to justify because they're simply a different kind of people. The way that Americans have been treating Black people and other minorities all along.
Yeah, there's a general unawareness, I think, not just in this country, but everywhere, of the fact that there were slaves who did rebel, even before the Revolutionary War. I'm thinking of Stono Rebellion in South Carolina, that sort of thing. Nat Turner later. Do you think that plays a role in all of this? The fact that there were people who were not, in fact, docile or anything like this image that people have kept and continued throughout the years?
Well, there was, so we may have not kept in living memory the names of these freedom fighters who rose up against their captors and tried to make a new life for themselves. But men and women of the 18th and 19th century knew their names well. And they formed the boogeymen that haunted the slave owners' nightmares. They were standing in the shadows behind all of this terrible martial legislation designed to keep Black people, especially in states and colonies where the Black population was really almost a majority or a majority of the population, like South Carolina, the echoes of the Stono Rebellion can be seen throughout the laws of those colonies and later states. Because of the fear that these isolated incidents inspired in white legislatures and white governors, white masters. So, you know, the image of the docile slave, the happy slave, the grateful slave, emerged as the other side of a coin. On one side, you have the terrifying freedom fighter, like Denmark Vesey or Nat Turner. And on the other side, the side that the master would prefer to contemplate, a Billy Lee, Washington's loyal manservant who served him throughout the Revolutionary War.
You're both a British and to a lesser degree, the colonists hoped to attract Black recruits during the war. And everybody talks about this number of 5,000 Blacks who were free and enslaved who fought for the Patriot side. But rarely do you hear the fact that the British used a couple of proclamations, Dunmore Proclamation, Phillipsburg Proclamation, and they got 20,000 people who went to their side hoping for freedom. Is that something that you hear a lot about from people, that they are not aware of that fact?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's difficult to, from this perspective, remember what the Revolutionary War must have felt like to people who experienced. We remember it now as the foundation moment of a great nation. At the time, however, people experienced it as a civil war within a region of the British Empire. And in choosing sides in that civil war, really what we're looking at is a triangular struggle. You have, as in many wars, passionate fighters on each side, passionate patriots, passionate loyalists, and then the vast apathetic middle, the people who are just trying to live their lives in dignity and safety, including the enslaved Americans, the African Americans. And in trying to push this great mass of the people into one camp or another, the Patriots and the Loyalists each had their stratagems. Lord Dunmore thought that he would frighten Virginians into obedience by threatening to free their slaves. In fact, he may have miscalculated, because it frightened more of them and more white Virginians into becoming patriots. At the same time, it swelled his ranks with Black men and women who heard for the first time a real opportunity to make themselves free. And many of them threw down their hoes and left to join the British side.
So I'm hearing you say then that it really is fair to say that some of the slave owners actually joined in the revolution, picked a side, picked being a patriot, because they wanted to protect slavery.
So the story of the revolution and its motivations is different depending on which region of the nation, of the incipient nation, you're talking about.
You're listening to Think. I'm John McKay, sitting in today for Chris Boyd. We're talking with law professor and historian Farah Peterson about her article, The Patriot Slave. It's in the American Scholar magazine. We'll continue our discussion after a short break. I'm John McKay, in today for Chris Boyd. My guest today is Farah Peterson, a legal historian and law professor at the University of Chicago Law School. Her latest article in the American Scholar magazine is entitled The Patriot Slave. You know, even those who paid attention in high school history class, they didn't hear a whole lot about blacks in the American Revolution. So how serious were the colonists about arming blacks and then recruiting them to fight?
You know, the idea had been mentioned to George Washington, and he was very resistant to it. As you know, he was a slave owner himself. Before the Revolution, he had between 100 and 200 slaves. By the time the Revolution was over, and certainly by the time of his death, that number had grown by to 300 to 400. And he knew the havoc it would wreak in the community that he cared about to suggest that that freedom was an option, to train Black people to fight for what you're calling liberty. He knew that that ideas of emancipation and of self-government wouldn't be far behind. So he was very resistant to that idea. But when the loyalists and the royal forces were so successful in recruiting Black troops that they could then use in the front lines of their battles and to do all the hard work of digging their trenches and building their fortifications. And when he realized that Northern militias were having a hard time filling out their ranks with white people, he started to change his tune.
Yeah, that's one thing that I think is missed by a lot of people, the fact that there was, in fact, a necessity to equip his army with people. And he simply wasn't getting enough people from the patriots who were being asked to arm themselves, right?
Yes, and in some places, Rhode Island offered freedom, unqualified freedom for any Black person who came ready to bear arms and serve in the militia. And as a result, something like 75% of Rhode Island's militia was Black. There were also high numbers in the other in the militias of other northern colonies, future states. And they were, in some cases, the most reliable fighters because they had nothing to go home to, you know. Whereas white militiamen typically served for 10 or 12 month rotations, a Black person who had been promised freedom on the condition that he stay in the army, stayed much longer, died at higher numbers, sacrificed. And so it became a boon, the willingness of Black soldiers to take a chance at freedom in this very dangerous, very difficult way, became a boon to both sides of the Revolutionary War.
You know, there was a plan, I understand, for some time to actually pay slave owners to provide slaves to the army?
Yes. And the deal that some northern militias had that, for example, Massachusetts, where the militia said, send your slave in your own place and we will count you as having served, that is a form of payment as well. So that kind of compensated service, you can find that both north and south.
Well, now the bulk of the Black soldiers in the war, I would imagine, were from the northern states. Some were escaped slaves, but some free. But the fighting slaves on the colonist side, they were not granted their freedom after the war.
The fighting slaves on the colonist side? Well, yeah. It depends on where they were from.
Okay.
From the north, often they signed up to serve in exchange, explicitly in exchange for their freedom. People who serve, Black men and women who worked for Washington in Virginia, for example, his body servant, Billy Lee, he was never promised freedom. That wasn't part of the deal. They were going along with their masters into war to do the same menial tasks for them with the same expectation or non-expectation of compensation as they had been doing their whole lives. They were going as possessions, not as people.
Now, what about the people who fought for the British? What happened to them? Granted freedom, or did the British, who had promised them emancipation, did they go through with their promise?
Oh, that is a mixed story. That is certainly a mixed story. It was not an easy road for none of these Black historical figures faced an easy road after they made their difficult decisions. One of the most shameful moments in the Revolutionary War must be when, under siege at Yorktown, Lord Cornwallis decided to send his own troops were running out of rations. And so instead of splitting it up and trying to save everyone, he drove the former slaves that he had promised freedom in exchange for the service, he drove them out into the middle ground between the armies to meet the mercy of their former masters. In fact, after Yorktown, George Washington recovered two of the 17 slaves that had escaped his plantation. But there are also good moments. Guy Carleton, who took over as general of the Royal Armies and was part of the negotiations of the evacuation after the Treaty of Paris, he had a conference with George Washington in which George Washington insisted that he follow through on the provision in the Treaty of Paris that said that all of the slaves would be returned to their masters. And the general refused. He said that would be a breach of the public faith to these men and women. And Britain will never breach its faith to anyone, regardless of their color. And so when he evacuated New York, he took about 3,000 Black men and women, most of them former slaves, with him, and resettled them in Canada, in London. And some of them eventually ended up in Sierra Leone.
After the Boston Massacre, we all heard in high school history that John Adams defended the British soldiers who killed the colonists, among them, of course, Crispus Attucks, an unarmed Black man. And we tend to praise Adams' defense of those soldiers as a great example of a legal system that really defended even an unpopular cause. But I know in your research, you've said we need to take a closer look at Adams' defense. And if we do, we might find something different.
Well, absolutely. You know, I had to reread the transcript of this famous trial because I was teaching a class on the history of civil procedure, of criminal procedure. And I must say that still remembering my own elementary school education and still holding it dear, even through the rigors of the PhD program, I was surprised at what I found, which was John Adams demeaning the victims as, in his words, just a rabble of Negroes. In effect, saying, oh, don't worry about acquitting these soldiers. They just killed a Black man and his cronies, and they don't deserve to hang for it. That element of John Adams' famous defense of the Boston Massacre suspects highlighted to me, and this was the first in the series of essays that I've written about these untold stories in American history, it highlighted to me that there are some difficult but important untold aspects of these founding era myths that are important to highlight and to understand if we are to know the true heritage of the problems we're facing today.
You touched on this earlier. Samuel Johnson, the rather famous person during the era, found it humorous and interesting that the colonists who had made their arguments based upon liberty and equality, that many of them were slave owners. I heard you smile. Was that a widespread argument that was made against by the British against what the colonists were calling for?
Oh, that is a funny quote. He says, why is it that we hear the loudest yelps for liberty among the drivers of Negroes? That was his exact words. You know, the way late 18th century Enlightenment figures like Thomas Jefferson reconciled this to themselves is rather interesting. And the way they would justify it changed over time. If you've ever read the first draft of Jefferson's Declaration of Independence, he has a provision in there. You know, the Declaration of Independence is a long list of offenses King George has committed against the colonies that justify their separation. And in his original list, he said, let me think if I can remember the words. He has waged cruel war against human nature itself, captivating and carrying Africans into slavery in another hemisphere or to incur miserable death in their transportation thither. Basically accusing King George of foisting slavery onto the American colonies against their will. And now that he has prevented them from eradicating slavery in spite of all of their supposed attempts, inspiring the slaves to rebel against and kill their masters. Okay, so the idea was, the way they justified it was this thought that both slave masters and the enslaved were victims of this old world way of being, were victims of government without consent. But now they were ushering in a Republican revolution, a new era of freedom that would redound to the benefit of all. And so a lot of these founding fathers believed that in time, and time was one of their favorite words, in time, slavery would somehow fade away on its own. Of course, the invention of the cotton gin interrupted any movement in that direction which might have ever happened. It made slavery so much more profitable and made it possible to imagine expanding the region in which slave labor would be valuable into the southwestern territories that were being more and more opened up. And so instead of gradually reducing to nothing, as they told themselves it would, slavery exploded in the 1790s and early 1800s.
You're listening to Think. I'm John McKay, sitting in today for Chris Boyd. Slavery was certainly, I imagine, discussed at the Constitutional Convention there. I remember this Gouverneur Morris quote about it being a nefarious institution and on and on. But that was about the only time that it was mentioned during that convention.
Well, they had quite a few conversations involving slavery, but very few that involved the morality of slavery. That said, one reaction that I've gotten to these essays is, you know, why are you dabbling in this revisionist history as if it's an offense against these good men to drag out these sort of dirty details of their past? But what reading Gouverneur Morris's speech in the convention reveals is that my history isn't revisionist at all. In fact, it's the history that paints the founding fathers as paragons of virtue with no downsides, people who should not be judged by the morals of our time because they could not have known that slavery was wrong. That is revisionist. What you can tell from reading the record is that they knew that what they were doing was wrong. Thomas Jefferson said, "I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just and that his justice cannot sleep forever," talking about slavery. Gouverneur Morris called it, called slavery a defiance of the most sacred laws of humanity. These were men who were keenly aware of the contradictions of their actions with their supposed values, and it bothered them, and it should also bother us.
When did you first become aware of the need for some new understanding about the founding and even recognizing what blacks went through during the war and afterward?
One of the treasures of the modern university is African American studies, but a problem with having it in its own department is that it is siloed. And in fact, African Americans and indeed other minorities are part of the American experience through and through. It's not possible to study any history of the American Republic without discussing the African-American experience alongside it. To do so is to look at a picture with part of it washed out. You're not going to get a full sense of what was happening, what the causes were, what the reactions were, how to explain what happened in the American story. So, you know, I came to these kinds of projects from the perspective of someone who had not studied African-American history specifically, but had been reared in an American history department, often reading classics of this genre that mentioned Black Americans only as an aside. When you start to look in the archives, however, read the Founding Fathers' words in their own writings, you see how central this problem was to their view of their own lives and their own project. And it starts to seem perverse and indeed manipulative to leave it out.
So when you were a graduate school, had an opportunity to take a closer look at some of the actual, I want to say founding documents, but some documents that were closer to the history. That's when you got some idea of what was really, really going on.
Well, yes, you know, and I don't, it's not that I'm saying that historians who have written our canonical texts did a bad job, not at all. Mm-hmm. History is an iterative process. Every generation can write the story in a different way as new voices become, start to seem newly relevant, as more people come to the table and say, hey, I want my voice heard. And in any telling of the American story, you are going to leave some things out, because to create a narrative out of a past that is just as complicated as the present involves some elision, some choices.
I'm John McKay in for Chris Boyd. Short break here on Think in our discussion with legal historian Farah Peterson, talking about the continuing historical delusion of the slave as patriot during and after the American founding. Our conversation continues in a moment. This is Think. I'm John McKay, in for Chris Boyd. Lingering misconceptions of the slave as patriot during the founding era and afterward continue to plague us today. That is the premise of legal historian Farah Peterson's article in the American Scholar magazine entitled The Patriot Slave. She is with us today. At the end of the war, you say that Americans who were looking for some national identity, they really built it around this idea of George Washington and his loyal patriotic slave, Billy Lee. And you can, in the article, you point out how you can see this in portraits, but almost every portrait you see of Billy Lee, he doesn't look the same.
That's right. It wasn't him as a person who was important to those memorializations of George Washington. It was the idea of him. It was the idea that slaves stood by and stayed loyal, even through the convulsions of the revolution and of what they would call the revolution of 1800, when Thomas Jefferson took over the presidency in a very difficult, very dangerous moment for the American experiment. These portraits often created at critical moments seem to celebrate, at least there's this one note of solidity, of dependability, the slaves. We can always rely on them as a sort of national resource in our times of trouble.
You know, in your article, you refer to American slavery before and after the revolution as creating a relationship of intimate violence. The idea of intimacy during any kind of institution like slavery would come as a surprise, I think, to most people, but you say that it really shouldn't.
No, and every time I teach a class that involves slavery, my students are shocked by the times that white slave owners refer to their slaves as their friends or their intimates, or show through their legislation that they respect the intellect of enslaved people by, for example, setting up mock trials that seem to provide some sort of due process before executions or tortures of various kinds. My students ask me, well, what is the point? Thinking, as many 21st century students do, that slavery could only have been justified if white people were thinking of their slaves as something like animals. But I tell them, look, this is a perspective that has been educated by looking through the lens of almost 100 years of Jim Crow. This fastidious separation between white and black that was fostered by this 100 years between Reconstruction and the Civil Rights Act, where Americans feared miscegenation, feared sharing water fountains, feared sitting next to each other. That is the opposite of the experience of white and black in the plantation South, where black women are breastfeeding white children, where black people are providing all the most intimate care to people in their aging years. Black people are the advisors that white slave masters go to talk about their financial condition, their crops, their plans for the future, where many black people serving as slaves on these plantations are in fact the children or grandchildren or cousins or brothers of the people that they must look to as their masters. It is a relationship of intimate violence. There's really no other way to describe it.
And Jim Crow has, as you pointed out, the exact opposite. I mean, you're talking separation as opposed to this close moving intimacy that people talked about, or that you're talking about with regard to before Jim Crow.
Absolutely. And why was Jim Crow necessary? It was to replace the more brutal hierarchy that that the slave code had created for the 19th. It was to recreate it in some other form.
You know, during both of these eras, and even now, this idea of, I guess, obscuring black self-determination, it continues to haunt us as a nation, and this is really trapping the entire country.
Yes, it is. The idea of the black person as either a freedom fighter or a Billy Lee in the antebellum period has been replaced now by another duality. We either have what President Trump calls thugs and looters on one side of the coin, or on the other side, these happy Democratic voters who come to the polls once every 4 years and then retreat to their segregated enclaves, never to be heard of again. Either way is undermining the reality, which is that black citizens are equally deserving of attention, investment, and respect in all throughout, and not just in these isolated moments of sort of extreme disapprobation or need.
Yeah, we've talked a little about this is an election year. In the protests over George Floyd, do we also see a link with this continuing myth of this patriot slave idea?
Yeah, I think we do. And you know, part of it is the surprise with which these protests have been met. I mean, ask yourself, why is the simple anodyne reflection that Black Lives Matter treated as such a threatening statement by so many? Why should something so simple feel so threatening? Why are people surprised to see the passion with which Black Americans, and by the way, white Americans this time too, have met the brutal video of the killing of George Floyd? The surprise could only come out of viewing Black Americans as somehow more passive than other Americans, as somehow not part of the society that stands up and demands rights when we're trampled on. But in fact, we share in that American characteristic. And, you know, more broadly, in this essay, I made the point that we Black Americans see ourselves as the protagonists of our story, not just as a bit character in someone else's. But as I reflected on that after I wrote it, I wondered whether I could have gone even further. I could have said to my white readers that we may well be the protagonists of your story, of the American story. It's through America's treatment of African Americans and other minorities that we can measure the strength of the values that this country claims to hold dear, including things like equal rights under law. And the measure we can take of America's values by looking at its treatment of its most vulnerable members is critical information, even for white Americans. I mean, after all, our character is our destiny. After witnessing babies torn out of the arms of mothers and fathers at the southern border, can anyone be surprised to see that the moms of Portland are being tear gassed and struck with rubber bullets? You know, after we've witnessed over the past few years the gutting of the Voting Rights Act, the closing of poll places, the gerrymandering, to all stratagems designed to reduce the power of the Black vote, can we be shocked when the president tries to gut the Postal Service to make it difficult and dangerous for all Americans, white and Black, to freely choose their government during a crisis? I think the point is that if you nurse totalitarianism at your breast, when it gets older, it will bite. The cruelty Americans have tolerated toward Black people and other minorities will not fail to hurt all of us in the end.
So what's great, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is the executive producer of a new film entitled Black Patriots, Heroes of the Revolution. He told NPR he's hoping to put the spotlight on the forgotten Black patriots fighting for the colonists. Among the most inspiring for him, Peter Salem, born enslaved but released by his owners to serve in the military. Here's a portion of that interview.
Peter Salem is absolutely a hero doing a heroic thing at a very crucial time. Peter Salem frustrated the final attempt by the British to take the field by shooting Major Pitcairn, who was an officer in the British Army. He shot him before he could gather the troops. The British professional soldiers thought that they could run our side off of the field because, you know, they weren't professional soldiers. But we changed their mind over the period of the Revolutionary War, and in the end, the British had to concede.
Do you think that this is going to be a benefit? Are we going to see more people who should be recognized as part of the American story coming out now with the films like this, with the research like you're doing?
I certainly hope so. It's important not just to pull down false monuments to a past that never existed, to a monochromatic past. It's important to fill in the record with all of those other voices, all those other people who were there, who were striving, who were living lives of honor and courage at the same time as the people we now know to celebrate. And indeed, you don't need to restrict it to the stories of those who fought on the Patriot side. Regardless of whether these Black British North Americans, these descendants of African captives were fighting for the British or fighting for the Patriots, they were all fighting for this Enlightenment value that America stands for, which is government by their consent. They were fighting for self-determination. They were fighting for the right to decide for themselves what they would do with their lives and how they would live. And that's worth celebrating as part of the core of American virtue, regardless of which side of the fight they found themselves on.
You're listening to Think. I'm John McKay, sitting in today for Chris Boyd. We're talking to University of Chicago law professor and historian Farah Peterson about her essay in The American Scholar titled The Patriot Slave. The piece explores the misconception that slaves during the founding era were content to remain enslaved during the American Revolution. You talked earlier in the program about trying to identify sources of history of the founding for your children. Have you been able to find some, or is that one of your long-term goals to identify a library of material for young people?
You know, I think that all Black parents face this challenge. How do we educate our children to love themselves and love this country at the same time? To grow up knowing that they are part of a proud history and that they too should see in themselves the future heroes and the past heroes of the Republic. I will continue to look for that material in my public library, but it's become increasingly clear to me that if I don't find it there, I will have to create it myself. And luckily, I follow in a long tradition of Black parents who've been doing this for generations of children in this country.
You know, the debate now seems to be, and you've touched on this, the debate over a different form of art, namely these Confederate monuments, which another example, I'd imagine, of this incomplete vision of the past, an inaccurate vision is, I guess, better way to say, of the past, right?
Well, yes. I mean, the Confederate States have taken on this outsized role as part of what Southerners think of as their heritage. It's important to remember that many of those Confederate statues that are being torn down now were not placed up right after the Civil War. They were not placed at the heads of these broad avenues and in front of these state houses until, in many cases, the 19-teens and 20s, as white Americans were also engaging in horrific race riots to destroy the progress that freed slaves had made around the country and to establish a new agreement on white supremacy and reconciliation between whites of the North and the South as the basis of American government going forward. So what do these statues really commemorate? It's that just to be honest about that would go some ways to healing the division and the hurt feelings among people who want to keep them and people who want to tear them down.
Farah Peterson is a legal historian and law professor at the University of Chicago Law School. We've been talking about her essay in the American Scholar magazine, The Patriot Slave. Farah, it has been a pleasure speaking with you today.
The pleasure is all mine, John.
You can follow us on Twitter at KERA Think. Use any podcast app to get the Think podcast, or go to our website, think.kera.org. Once again, I'm John McKay, and today for Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.